Okay, thank you. I was going to start with a joke, except I saw Juan work so hard yesterday and they all fell flat, and I decided this is a grumpy crowd. It's never going to work. I'll just go to my seminar, which the first thing I wanted to point out is there's some papers there, and I had some very smart collaborators, in particular, Ivan and Anthony are in the audience, so if you're interested, you could also get some pointers from them. So I'm going to start with my favorite slide of all time, which is holographic entanglement entropy. So this goes back to 2006 and our friends Shinsei Ryu and Tadashi Takenagi, and what they did is they reminded us or taught many of us that there are interesting questions I can ask that are related to entanglement in the boundary theory. And in particular, there's the question of how to calculate entanglement entropy. And even for a free field, that can be a challenging problem in general, let alone now for holography, we're talking about strongly coupled CFTs with many degrees of freedom. But what they did is they translated this difficult problem in the boundary theory into a beautiful geometric problem in the bulk, where I'm looking at all these surfaces that are hanging down. I evaluate the Bekenstein-Hawking formula on those surfaces. I find the surface that gives me the minimum value, and that can be interpreted then as the entanglement entropy in the boundary problem. Now, that was somewhat of a surprise at the time, and it took us a while as a community to catch on and realize that this was a really great idea, but it evolved to the point where it was really a fruitful dialogue between the bulk and the boundary, in that, you know, we learned new lessons about quantum field theories, but we also started to learn new lessons about the nature of quantum gravity and how it stores information, say. And that gave rise then to a slogan that space-time geometry equals entanglement. And I've put Mark's name there, but I'm not blaming the slogan on him. Rather, I'm pointing out that the slogan is really an idea that he emphasized for us, that entanglement of the microscopic degrees of freedom is really a key ingredient in the emergence of a space-time, a smooth space-time. The slogan actually probably goes to Lenny Susskind, and so it was somewhat disconcerting a few years later. He came along with a paper titled Entanglement is Not Enough. But what his paper was really saying is that entanglement entropy is only one diagnostic of entanglement in a quantum state, and that we should think about other kinds of diagnostics to really fully understand the nature of the states. And in particular, in the context of holography, as the quote says there, what he was worried about, or what he was interested in, was understanding, using these entanglement probes, to understand the physics behind black hole horizons. And so as my picture here shows, a certain group of people known as the Event Horizon Telescope Collaboration have worked really hard to show us what a black hole looks like. Unfortunately, today, all you're going to get is stick figure black holes, the usual Penrose diagram for an ADS black hole. And what Lenny was interested in, well, this represents, of course, a thermofield double state, so coupling the two asymptotic boundaries is like entangling the two CFTs represented or living on the boundaries of my space-time. What Lenny was interested in, of course, was the region behind the horizon, and in particular, there's perhaps interesting physics to understand up at the top near the singularity. His proposal was that we should think about a new diagnostic called holographic complexity. And the idea was really that, you know, entanglement entropy, while it's a very robust probe, it only is sensitive to certain features of the reduced density matrix, in particular the eigenvalues, and he wanted to think about a probe that was sensitive to the fuller structure of the state, perhaps the thermofield double state, or the reduced density matrix that we might construct. So here we have a new idea. I should remind you what complexity is, or what I'm thinking about when I speak about complexity in the rest of the talk. So it is what it sounds like. Complexity is how difficult is it to implement a task, and in particular, I'm going to be thinking about the task of preparing a particular quantum state, in particular, the state in the boundary theory. And so we're going to use a model from our friends in quantum information, the quantum circuit model, and there we're going to start with a simple reference state. And simple is in the eye of the beholder, and so usually we think of simple as meaning an unentangled state. And so if I have a bunch of qubits, a string of qubits, we might think of the state where they're all simply in the down, spin down state individually. Now I want to take my reference state and transform it to some particular favorite state or a target state. And so I'm got to find a unitary that'll transform the initial state to the target state. And I'm going to build that unitary, though, in a very particular way. I'm going to specify a simple set of gates that only act on a few degrees of freedom at a time. And I'm going to put those together in a circuit, like here. And so the idea is that by putting those building blocks together and acting on my reference state, I'll build up the desired target state. Now, if I'm using discrete modules like this with discrete operations, it may be very, very difficult to get precisely to the desired target state. And so often, the folks that study this seriously or more seriously in the circuit context will introduce a tolerance so that if I get within an epsilon by some measure of my target state, I'll declare the task has been accomplished. And so complexity is then the simple thing that I just have to count up the number of gates in my circuit, but actually I'm tasked with the job of finding the optimal circuit or the shortest possible circuit to accomplish this preparation, and that number of gates is then giving me, or it is, what we define or may define as the complexity. Now, I should say that this is then what I have in mind when I'm talking about complexity for the rest of my talk. A lot of people motivated or in the holographic complexity area have, you know, gone off in other directions. For example, some folks may be interested not in some simple unentangled state, but just starting with a favorite state and then evolving it or moving it to another state. And so there's been a lot of progress in that perspective. It's a slightly different task. It's a slightly different procedure. But that's also another story that's been seriously investigated in the context of holographic complexity. And then there are other directions, for example, Krylov complexity, et cetera, et cetera. But this is the idea that I have in the back of my mind when we're moving forward. The last question, though, I'll mention is that this is a rather fuzzy definition of what complexity is. I'm specifying lots of different things, but there's a lot of freedom in what you might choose as the reference state, what you might choose as your gates. And so a valid question is, does the answer I get for the complexity depend on all of these choices? And the answer is yes. And so that'll be a theme that arises and occurs through the rest of the talk. So here's a great new idea coming from our friends in quantum information. And we're looking for a translation to some geometric observables or gravitational observables. And so Lenny provided suggestions there as well. or in particular, there are two proposals. One is complexity equals volume, and this is comparing very much to holographic entanglement entropy, but rather than looking at a small region on a given time slice, I think about the entire time slice, and then I'm in particular in my thermofield double, and then I look for a surface, a space-like surface that connects those two, and as shown in the formula, I evaluate the volume of that surface. I maximize it because the variations are in the time-like direction, and then the maximal value is something that we can think of as a measure of the complexity of our boundary state. Alternatively, with complexity equals action, what I can do is I think about a region of the space-time, and you might think of this as the causal domain of that extremal surface on the other side. And given that region, what I do is I just evaluate the gravitational action on that region, and that as well can be taken as a measure of the complexity of the boundary state. One of the nice things about both of these gravitational observables is that they're going to probe the interior of the black hole to arbitrarily late time. So as I push up in the upward direction in my picture, the T left and T right, I push everything forward, those two observables are always still going to be reaching behind the black hole and probing the physics behind the horizon. In passing, I'll also say that some folks out in Texas, or at the time in Texas, also made another suggestion of complexity or holographic complexity, which is complexity equals volume 2.0 or complexity equals space-time volume. What they suggested is you take the Wheeler-DeWitt patch that arose in complexity equals action and simply evaluate the volume of that space-time region. And that also might be a measure of the complexity of the boundary state. So we've got a new idea, the complexity, we've got some gravitational observables, but why would I think that they're related to one another? And there are a couple of reasons here. Another would be all of these these circuits that we saw this morning in the various models that were being discussed, but I'm going to focus on these two key features, where I'm not going to explain in any depth today, but one can make qualitative arguments that in the holographic CFTs, we should see behavior like this. In particular, that when I'm looking at very late times, when I'm pushing forward, upward in the diagrams, that the rate of growth of the complexity should be a constant. And in particular, this is a feature that you see for both of these. And in particular, the constant is proportional to the mass. Another feature is the switchback effect. And there, what I'm doing is I'm perturbing the state in a very particular way, in a zigzag way. And what one finds is a linear growth overall for large separations of my perturbations, but there's also a delay known as the scrambling time for each one of the zigzags in my probe. And that can be realized in the holographic or in the gravitational setting by probing the black holes with shock waves. So that then gives us a connection between our gravitational observables and this idea of complexity in the boundary theory. Now, I'm going to turn to the question, though, who told us volume, or who told, well, Lenny did, but where did that come from? It's rather like pulling a rabbit out of a magician's hat. And there were some ideas that perhaps this is related to the ambiguities that I talked about before in defining the complexity. You know, there was the reference state, the gate set, one might weight different gates differently, and so there is a lot of ambiguity there, but it seems that I have a set of discrete choices, and so is that really all that we can do? So let's go back and look at holographic complexity, or not to the complexity equals volume proposal. So there, what I'm doing is, well, I'm following this procedure that I described before, but I'm going to break it down, and I'm going to tell you that we're actually doing two things here. First, there's the maximization, and so what that's doing is it's picking out a very special surface that's connecting my boundary time slices. And then given that surface, what I'm doing is I'm evaluating a geometric feature, namely the volume for that particular surface. And combining those two steps, that gives me a nice diffeomorphism invariant observable. So if I break up the procedure in that way, I realize that I can do lots, or my collaborators and I realize that we could do lots of interesting things. In particular, I could just think about these codimension surfaces, one surfaces, and evaluating some scalar built out of various curvatures or extrinsic curvatures. And then I'll ask that I extremize that by, you know, varying the position or the embedding of my surface in the space-time. So that's the first step. That'll pick out a particular surface. Then the second step is that I should evaluate some geometric feature of that surface. And again, what I can do is I can build some covariant scalar out of curvatures, background curvatures or extrinsic curvatures, and just integrate that across the surface. And combining those two steps with all of the inherent freedom there, that'll give me a nice diffeomorphism invariant observable. And so at this point, we might ask, so what? Well, it's a talk about holographic complexity, and so we worked a little bit harder, and we looked at what are the features of these observables when you look at them in the context of a ADS black hole. And so one of the things you find is that quite generally, these observables all grow linearly with time, or that at late times, the rate of growth of the observable is just a constant. And for a very large class, that constant is in fact proportional to the mass. Further, you can probe or throw shock waves into the black holes, and you can evaluate these observables. And again, what you find, just as before, is the telltale sign of a time delay or the switchback effect. So in fact, what I've done then, or what we've done, is created a huge set of gravitational observables that all of which display these key features that we asked of our observables to be complexity or to be complexity-like. And so it seems that they're all equally viable candidates for holographic complexity. So let's look at a simple example. And so I'm going to choose the function that I extremize and the function that I evaluate to be the same. It starts with a 1, so if it was just 1, I'd be talking about complexity equals volume, but I'm adding to it some, if you like, perturbation, where I've got the square of the Weyl tensor, and so I'm throwing some curvature terms in there. When I evaluate this in a simple planar black hole background, and I'm using V, an infalling coordinate, you know, I get an effective action-like thing where it depends on the blackening factor, and there's this factor of A, that's really the function that I'm talking about. It's 1 plus some contribution coming from the curvature. And there's I've introduced a world volume coordinate, and so I need to do some gauge fixing, which I do in a clever way, being motivated by what we've seen already with complexity equals volume. There's also a conserved momentum, which it turns out governs the rate of growth at late times. And at the end of the day, I can combine those last two statements to rearrange the problem in terms of a simple classical mechanics problem, which is now picking out or determining the profile of my surface. Now, I pointed out that A, and it pops up in different places, and so that's really the places where the effect of the curvature is being seen in this version of the problem. The rest of it, if A was just 1, I'd be just studying complexity equals volume. So let's look at what the potential looks like. If the coupling is positive, then it starts very negative out at infinity. It comes up, it passes through zero at the horizon. That's because of the blackening factor in my potential, that F factor. And then it rises up, it finds an extremum, it dips down, but then it takes off to infinity again as you approach zero, because again, in the A factor, I've got the curvature, and the curvature is blowing up at the singularity at R equals zero. And so the trajectories that I'm gonna look at are simply trajectories that start at infinity, they come in, they hit the potential, and then they bounce out again. That's exactly what you would expect if you drew a picture like this. The surface starts at one boundary on one side of the black hole at R equals infinity. It comes in, it crosses the horizon, it reaches some minimum radius, and then it bounces back, which means that it starts heading out on the other side of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Now, the key thing here, though, is that extremum, because it turns out that that really controls the late time behavior of the complexity or the linear growth. I've shown there a small graph on the bottom, which is the boundary time, which is another integral that we have to do, corresponding to all these different values of the energy or the conserved momentum. And you can see that there's a pole in the middle at some special value, which is P infinity, which actually corresponds to this trajectory right or tuned so that it would just reach the maximum in our potential there. You can also see from the graph there's two sets of solutions, some where the energy is in the blue region or below the peak, and some in the region where the energy is the effective energy is above the peak. You have to pick out the global maximum, and it turns out that those are the simple ones. They're the ones that are closest to the ones we found for complexity equals volume in this region, running from zero up to the maximum. Now, I have to explain the almost in my title. So the story I just told exhibited all the nice features that I wanted, but it relied on having this maximum in my potential. And if you look at it a bit harder, what you find is that the coupling, this coupling constant lambda, which controlled the strength of the Weyl tensor squared term, can't be too large, because if it's too large, or if it's too large and positive, it stretches the potential and there's no extremum. And so what are we going to do then? There's also another problem if lambda becomes too small or too negative, but I'm going to focus on the positive end of that range. So there the extremum has disappeared, and so we might do these integrals again and evaluate boundary times, and what you find is that the boundary time starts at zero, it rises up to some maximum, and then it shrinks down again. And so it seems that there's a maximum time that I can get to with these extremal surfaces. And you might notice the tuning there, that as I go past the critical value, very quickly this bump or this maximum shrinks back to very close to zero. So what are we going to do? Well, it seems that there should be something happening. There should be an extremal surface, or at least a maximal surface, beyond that value. So we can just think about what's happening, and we can go, imagine I choose my boundary time beyond the maximum, where I can find these extremal surfaces anchoring to the boundary. Then I know that I can have space-like surfaces that stretch between my boundary time surfaces. And in general, it's some space-like surface, and so it'll sweep some trajectory, or I can pick surfaces that basically fill the entire Wheeler-DeWitt patch, which are bounded then by these light sheets. Now, somewhere in there, there has to be one that gives me or it seems that there has to be one that gives me a maximum for the particular observable that I want. And so I'm going to think about, and this is just a cartoon, let's have a family of surfaces that sweeps through the entire Wheeler DeWitt patch. So it's going to start on the past light sheets. It'll go up through, say, the extremal surface and then up towards the singularity. And if I'm doing complexity equals volume, and I ask, you know, what is the volume for this family of surfaces? Well, it starts at zero on the past null sheets because they are null sheets. The volume is shrunk to zero. There will be a maximum value corresponding to the extremal surface, and then it'll shrink back down to zero because, again, the surfaces are null, where the volume vanishes, and it turns out that on the singularity, the volume has also shrunk to zero, and so it reaches zero up at the top. And so if I think about now introducing the perturbation where I add the c squared, I get a picture that, and I apologize, it looks like the potentials that I'm drawing before, but this is not the potential, this is the observable. Again, it starts at zero because the measure has vanished on the past null sheets. As I sweep through the Wheeler DeWitt patch, there'll be some maximum at some point, and then it'll dip down because there's another saddle, I told you, somewhere in the middle. And then, in fact, it takes off, and it takes off here because the Weyl curvature is diverging. And so when I evaluate my observable 1 plus c squared integrated over the surface, it's going to actually diverge as I go to the top of the Wheeler DeWitt patch. Now, this was when lambda was less than the critical value. If I go above the critical value, in my potential, the extrema have vanished. But similarly here, then, I shouldn't expect to find extremal values for the observable as the surface sweeps through. But it still, it starts at zero at the past boundary of the Wheeler DeWitt surface and monotonically increases then towards the top of the Wheeler DeWitt surface. And so it looks like the real maximum is way up here at the top. That may be a little bit disconcerting. You can regulate the observable by introducing some, say, c to the fourth term to your observable, and that, with the appropriate sign, regulates the problem. Then I'll have a maximum that's way up there, but as my variable, my new coupling goes to zero, the critical value, that ratio got flipped, but the critical value then shrinks to the singularity. And in fact, I match on to the divergence I saw before. So what's happening in this regime is that there is a surface that gives us the maximal value of the observable, but it's been pushed to the edge of the phase space. It's been pushed to the top of the Wheeler DeWitt patch. And in fact, this happens for any time, and it's applicable for any positive value of lambda. So in particular, even below the critical value of lambda, I should be thinking that the true maximum is way up there. Of course, similar issues happen in many, many different instances. In particular, you have to be careful about how the integrand is behaving as you approach the singularity. Of course, this still works for negative values, and there's another interesting story. If lambda is less than minus one, which was the other end of the allowed range, but I'm going to skip over that today. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn to complexity equals action and complexity equals space-time action, and I'm going to ask, how might we generalize that particular story? In that case, you know, it doesn't look like there's any kind of extremization procedure. We're just given a region of space-time, and we're told evaluate something in that region. However, emboldened by what we saw before, we're going to actually invent a new procedure that follows a two-step process. In particular, we're going to think about defining a special region that is bounded by a surface in the future and a surface in the past. Everything's going to be anchored on our boundary time slices, the T left and the T right. Once I go through some extremization procedure to find the special surfaces, I'm then going to evaluate again some feature of this new region. And, I went the wrong way, apologize. And so here we go. We have some far more complicated looking expressions because I can include functionals not just in the bulk region, that region M in between, I can include functionals on the top and the bottom, so boundary terms. I'm going to extremize with respect to the embedding of both of those surfaces. And that'll pick out then a particular region in the bulk of my space-time or in the black hole. And then what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to evaluate some geometric features. Again, there's a lot of freedom. I get to pick various functionals, both on the boundaries and in the bulk or in the middle region M. And in doing so, I, again, with this two-step procedure, produce a nice diffeomorphism invariant observable. And if I work a little bit harder, in fact, I find that in general, they seem to exhibit linear growth at late times and the switchback effect. And so again, we've been able to generalize these observables that involve regions of the space-time to a much broader class. In this case, I'm going to again look at a very, very simple example. In particular, I'm just going to evaluate the volume of the boundary surfaces, and then I'm going to add the volume of the intermediate, the bulk region, except I'm introducing these parameters alpha plus and alpha minus to weight the boundary terms or to separate the two boundary terms and to weight them in different ways. Now, there's a story that one can tell about effective potentials and all of that, but in this particular case, there's a much more elegant geometric version of the story. It turns out that extremizing that functional gives us boundary surfaces that are constant mean curvature slices. In particular, what I mean is that the trace of the extrinsic curvature is constant on the extremal surfaces. Now, one of the interesting things is that is controlled, or those extrinsic curvatures are controlled by these parameters, alpha plus and minus. And in the limit where the parameters are going to zero, it seems that the two extrinsic curvatures are diverging. What does that mean? Well, it means that for alpha plus going to zero, I'm actually pushing the future surface further and further upward, and in particular, alpha plus goes to zero, I push it as far as it can go, namely to the two null sheets, and then it crosses or it hugs the horizon. Similarly for the past surface, and so in that limit that the two parameters go to zero, it turns out that these become the future and past light sheets, and the region that we selected out is none other than the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. So if I evaluate the action on my favorite region, then I get complexity equals action. If I evaluate the space-time volume, I get this second version of complexity equals volume. And so this new approach, in fact, encapsulates or captures both of these two procedures, which are more familiar or that were introduced originally. So that's fun, but I'm going to try and do something just a little more interesting. I'm going to work with this example. We're going to extremize this functional, but I'm going to think about, in particular, the limit where alpha plus is not zero, but it's very, very small, and that means that the top boundary there is going very close to the singularity. And so this then gives us an observable that might be probing the singular region in the geometry. I get to evaluate some functional on my new extremal region. But since I'm particularly interested in the singularity, I'm just going to focus on the term corresponding to the future surface, the sigma plus, and I'm going to discard the two functionals or the opportunity to evaluate something in the bulk or on the path surface. And we're going to think about what different choices of that functional F1 on the future surface give us. So this is what I said before. It turns out that at late times, as alpha plus is approaching zero, the surface gets hung up on a particular radius surface very close to the singularity. And essentially, as time moves forward, the surface is spreading out across this critical surface at RF. Now, we can evaluate different functionals. In particular, if we evaluate one, we get a familiar-looking expression, although it's got an extra power of alpha plus, which is becoming arbitrarily small. That's arising because the space-time volume, or the volume of these surfaces, is shrinking to zero as I approach the singularity. If I stick the extrinsic curvature in, that gives us an inverse power of alpha plus, and so I get a familiar-looking constant proportional to the mass. I can also stick in the curvature, and in this case, I get the same or a similar-looking proportionality constant, but now there's a 1 over alpha cubed, and that's reflecting the fact that the curvature is diverging as I approach the singularity. Now, I'm going to compare this, these results to a charged black hole, but before I go there, I just want to remind you that that M, the reason, well, some of the arguments presented on why the coefficient here should be M is actually that it's proportional to the entropy, which reflects the number of degrees of freedom, and then the times the temperature, which is giving us a time scale, since we're looking at a time rate of change of a dimensionless number. So let's look at what happens when I look at a charged black hole. In this case, the singularities have become time-like, and I can only really probe the space-time with these surfaces up to the Cauchy horizon. And in fact, there, the as alpha plus is becoming smaller and smaller, it gets hung up on a surface very close to the Cauchy horizon. I can go through and I can evaluate the same things. In the case where I'm looking at the volume, again, I'm getting something that becomes arbitrarily small because I'm looking at surfaces where the volume measure is vanishing. When I have the extrinsic curvature, I get a constant. And when I get the, when I look at, in this case, the curvature squared, in fact, it goes to zero because the curvature is well-behaved in this region of the space-time, but again, the volume measure is shrinking to zero. The curious thing, though, about these results is, well, the observable is getting, probing the region near the Cauchy horizon, and so I get an expression there involving an entropy and a temperature, but it's really the effective entropy and the effective temperature of the inner horizon, not the outer horizon in this particular case. So those are some examples, but what have we really learned? Well, one of the things I think I've learned from this exercise is that there are many different ways, many different observables that, you know, could play the role of complexity in the boundary theory. And I really think we should embrace that rather than thinking of it as a problem. It's a feature of this particular quantity. And one of the reasons we might embrace that is, as I said before, there are ambiguities in defining the complexity. And so it's good that we see that there are ambiguities or there's a great deal of freedom in defining these gravitational observables. But in particular, what I showed you is that by studying families of these observables, we can actually start to systematically understand what the physics or what the geometry behind the horizon is actually doing. Another observation which I thought was interesting is that, you know, if I, in particular now, fix the time slice, I can Okay, very quickly. Well, there's an interesting feature that, you know, by tuning the observable in different ways, I'm probing different regions of the space-time, and all of that information is encoded in the same boundary state. That's perhaps not surprising, because I'm just sweeping out different elements or different parts of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. But what we, in the boundary theory, would be saying is by optimizing our circuits in different ways, we're making different features of the space-time geometry manifest. Well, yeah, we've introduced this two-step process. You might wonder what that means in terms of the boundary circuits. I'm happy to talk to you about that later. Really, the key challenge here is to find a more precise interpretation of all these observables in terms of some quantity like complexity or some procedure like evaluating the complexity in the boundary theory. There are then lots of things to explore, and I'll just leave it there for questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Yes.
So what is, I have two questions. What is the motivation, once you separate the extremization from the evaluation, why have the extremization, why not, you know, a slice that solves some equation that's not obtained extremizing, or some other property that the slice might, that might pick out a slice?
Sorry?
So well, I mean, so it, once you separate the extremization from evaluating the functional, and you're not extremizing the functional you're evaluating anymore.
Yeah.
You're extremizing. Why do an extremization at all? Why not just have some other property that, some equation you write down that the slice obeys, or some other property that picks out a slice? I mean, what's the motivation for now extremizing something?
No, if you came up with a way to define your equation in a way that was, I mean, ultimately what I'm doing is I'm defining observables in a simple way that yields something that's diffeomorphism invariant. If you have an alternate way to pick out your special surface that still has that feature, I'd be happy with it.
I mean, an example which you eventually landed on with a more complicated procedure is the CMC slice, which is extremizing a more complicated functional that's the sum of an area and a space time volume and everything. I mean, that would be an example. My second question is, I think you said this, but I missed it. When the slice ends up coming close to the singularity in some of your examples, is it literally is it being pushed literally to the singularity, or it's sort of close to the singularity?
In the regime I was looking at it, it was close to the singularity, but if you took alpha all the way to zero, it would shrink to R equals zero. That formula in the middle of the slide.
I see. So it's still, it's not wanting to actually coincide with the singularity. Whereas I guess in the complexity equals action or complexity equals space-time volume, it's literally including the singularity itself. I mean, I wonder if there's some difference in the physics in those two cases.
I'll use that question as an opportunity to say that, you know, here, by looking at a suite of observables, you're able to ask questions, or you're getting different pieces of the geometry coming out. You know, with complexity equals action, you get one shot at it. It's, you know, in fact, you are evaluating, you know, as part of the boundary term, you are evaluating that K on the surface that hugs the singularity, and that's part of the contribution, but extracting all of that from everything else is difficult. I'd say this is a more direct way to see geometry.
In the case of entropy, the entropy had to obey a bunch of constraints, and they were useful to check the formula and gain confidence on the formula.
Yeah.
I guess I wonder what properties complexity should have that would be interesting to know whether there are some non-trivial properties that it should have so that one could check various possibilities.
No, well, I use the word, you know, when I talked about late time growth and the switchback effect, that these are qualitative arguments. It's unfortunate that we don't have a lot of precise calculations or precise inequalities to compare to. You know, one simple one that you can think about is the complexity ought to be a positive number. In this particular case, that's really, though, going to be controlled by the asymptotic behavior and the divergences there. But I don't have other feature. Manu?
Yeah. So could you comment on what have we learned about the inside, what are features inside the horizon or close to the singularity? Is that motivated by the thinking that we could have computed these observables irrespective of holography or complexity? We could just have computed these observables which go close and probe the singularity. But since the boundary picture is not very clear, could you comment on what exactly have we learned about the interior? Or
no, I think you're asking what are we learned about the boundary? Or
since we don't know anything about the boundary and we are thinking of, you say we are probing the singularity. If we knew something, what the boundary picture was, then we could have learned something. That it's more clear to me we would be learning something about the singularity. But since the boundary picture is not clear, these observables we could have defined irrespective of holography.
No, absolutely.
I'm not very clear what exactly have we learned about the singularity or the interior.
Well, I presented, the focus here has been presenting a new set of gravitational observables in this space-time that you can evaluate. I think that's really one of the things that Lenny drew our attention to is these observables that are associated with codimension one surfaces or regions of space-time. And I'm just saying that, well, in fact, there's a whole slew of them. But what we've learned, the interesting features of these is that they all behave in this way to give you the linear growth and the switchback effect.
Okay, thanks.
More questions? Yeah. You should just throw it out. I don't trust myself.
I just wondered if you've thought much about complexity for states that are superpositions of different states. Like it seems like the volume or anything prescription would be some kind of average of those, but maybe from the quantum mechanical side, the complexity could be very different for a superposition of two states.
No, it's certainly true that what we're doing is the short answer is no. The longer answer is, I'm relying on a classical background, and I'm looking at the saddle point of some quantity. Another direction that needs to be explored is, how do you go beyond just that saddle point approximation? What would be the quantum corrections? That's not quite answering the question that you had, but it'd be a simpler set of quantum corrections to try and understand.
Yeah, if you have a quantum algorithm for preparing two states, then there's also an algorithm for preparing a superposition as long as the coefficients aren't really small. So then, roughly speaking, you would guess that the scaling of the superposition would be the max of the complexities of the two states themselves. There might be a better way to do it, right? But at least that's a sort of worst case bound.
You're allowing insulin?
But no, actually, you don't actually need them, though. There's a way to do it with Grover where you don't need them. Maybe you need one, I'm not sure.
It could be much, much larger than the either complexity, to depend on the inner product of the two states.
As long as you're not preparing a superposition that has very small coefficients, I think it should be okay.
Suppose they're two very different geometries.
Yeah, that's fine.
Then the inner product between those states would be extremely small.
Yeah.
So then the Grover search version would have a much higher.
Yeah, I think there's some way of doing it. I don't know, we have this in the appendix of our paper, but I don't remember exactly. But I think when they're close to orthogonal, it's fine.
Fine in what sense?
It's not much harder than it is to prepare them separately.
Patrick, did you have a question?
Any more questions? Yes.
No.
Okay, so I just have a simple question. So in the last slide, you basically say maybe different definition for the complexity correspond to different optimization. I'm a little bit confused about that because I think for the system, you fix Hamiltonian and you fix the time, you basically, you know, the complexity by definition is like the best optimized, you know, the gain number, which is a fixed number. Why do you think you define different quantity for the holographic complexity with different optimization?
Well, if you have a prescription for defining the complexity, I agree, you're going to get a number. But the thing is that I could choose a different prescription. I may weight the gates in a different way. I may choose a slightly different reference state. And so in that sense, there are ambiguities. Those are the ambiguities I was talking about. But I'm not sure if I'm answering.
Oh, okay. So if we follow that idea, then I'm a little bit confused about further things. So some definition of the holographic complexity probes very close to singularity, but some does not, right?
Yeah.
So it seems like we probably want to say that different reference give us very different, like, geometry probe, some, like, know something about singularity, something does not know that much.
It could be in the reference state. I mean, it could be in these other ambiguities. I don't have I'm not going to give any intuition for what choices I'm making.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. If there are no more questions, let's take it up again, and we can continue the discussion during the coffee break.